Well, I think we can go ahead and get started. This is our final class on 1 Corinthians. We'll do a little bit of review and then just kind of cover chapter 16 like we normally cover a chapter. Can anybody remind us as we get started here what the major breakdown of the book is? We remember that the first part of the book, Paul is responding to reports. And the second part of the book, Paul is responding to questions. Does anybody remember what chapters it is that he is responding to reports? It's 1 through 6. Yeah, very good. 1 through 6, he's responding to reports. And then chapters what through what, he's responding to questions.
7 to 16, I guess.
Yeah, 7 through 16. And who was it that gave the reports to Paul?
Chloe's people.
Chloe's people, yeah. So Chloe's people told Paul about some of the problems in Corinth. What were some of the problems?
They were dividing after teachers.
Yep.
They had some sexual immorality that they were tolerating and even boasting in their maybe open-mindedness.
Right, very good. And they were also going to judge Judy before the open public, I guess. I guess the public knew about some of that. What other kind of problems did they have?
They appeared to have some problems with understanding the unity of the truth, the singularity
yes.
of the message.
Yeah, good. And a lot of that accompanied the miraculous gifts and how they should be using those things. They had a lot of problems with those things. Related to the sexual sin, they had people who were not married that were having sex, which is adultery or fornication. And then they had people who were married who were not having sex with each other. And so you had unholy activity and unholy abstinence, I guess. And so they had all kinds of polarizing extremes that were going on in the church. The sacrifices about truthful worship, how they should worship, is it okay to go to the temples and eat some of the meat sacrificed to idols, even though you know it's nothing. And so we talked about some of that at that point. So, all right, so that's just a little bit of review on 1 Corinthians. It's really just a letter filled with corrections for a lot of moral problems that a church had. And we've talked about this before, but out of all the churches in the New Testament, all of the cities that we know of in the New Testament, Corinth may be the most similar to the United States. And obviously there's still going to be some differences, but with the schisms that they had, they really enjoyed certain personalities and how they preached, and they weren't as focused on the content of what they were preaching. Our culture is very sexually sinful. I guess I'll just say it that way. I guess like a lot of cultures throughout history, we've got questions about sacrifices, and maybe some of those questions could be, could I go to a same-sex wedding? You know, like back then when they were going to these temples, they were going to like social gatherings and social weddings and whatever. Are there certain things like that that we should abstain from going to? All right, so as we get into chapter 16, just a couple of introductory things that I want to point out here.
Hey, Eric.
Yeah, was somebody going to say something?
Well, I was just going to add a comment. When you step way back and look at all this stuff, and you look at sexual promiscuity, at the immorality, at the polarization that divides, the rampant lawsuits, and you say, wow, that's not so different from what we're facing today. There's sometimes a little bit of a source of comfort in that, you know, in that, like Solomon said, there's nothing new under the sun. The sins that we're seeing around us today were present in biblical times, and the Bible speaks to those things.
Yes, very good. Yeah, which makes this book extremely relevant, like every portion of Scripture is. This one, I think, is maybe more obviously relevant. And it's also a good book to study with a new Christian. You know, these are this book deals with a lot of the morality matters that a new Christian may question and wonder about. So and obviously throughout the rest of the year there's going to be more said about 1 Corinthians 15, because that's where our theme passage is this year. And I do want to direct you right now to the theme verse that we have for the year, the final verse in 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul says, "Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain." Let me point out that in chapter 16, what we're going to see are examples of works that are not, quote unquote, done in vain. And so we're going to see some things about the collection for the saints. We're going to see some things about other places Paul wants to preach at. We're going to see some final instructions that he's going to give us. We get kind of an example, several examples of, okay, what are some of the works that we can be doing that are not in vain because Jesus has risen from the dead? And by the way, this is the chapter that talks about the collection. The collection of the saints is related to Paul's travel plans. And as you'll see on this outline here, the first four verses deal with the collection, 5 through 12 deal with travel plans, not just for Paul, but for Timothy and Apollos as well. And then he's got some final instructions and some greetings. So as Paul is talking about his travel plans, that's related to the collection because he's got to go to some other places to collect the rest of the money. So that's kind of how this chapter and how 1 Corinthians is going to wrap up as we look at this text. Anything you guys want to say before we start looking at the collection in verses 1 through 4? All right, let's go ahead and read 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1 through 4. "Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so you also are to do. On the first day of every week, each of you is to put something aside and store it up as he may prosper, so that there will be no collecting when I come. And when I arrive, I will send those whom you accredit by letter to carry your gift from to Jerusalem. If it seems advisable that I should go also, they will accompany me." All right. This is an important passage for a lot of reasons. But at the end of the letter, after he's talked about all the moral problems that they have, he's giving them a positive good deed that they can engage in, which I think sometimes helps sort out some of our moral problems, that if we can get the attention off of ourselves and get it more on the good works that we can be doing, that gets our focus in the right place. But you'll notice that the collection is for the saints. Who does that mean that the collection is not for?
It's not for the non-saints.
It's not for non-saints. Or, yeah. Yeah, that's right. And let me just show you. In the New Testament, the collection of the local church is never used for non-Christians. Now, the reason that I want to bring this up is because this is one of those doctrinal questions that a lot of people wonder about. Can we use the church treasury money to support orphans' homes? Can we use it to support colleges? Can we use it to support, to help some of the needy people in the community and stuff like this? I'm not saying Christians can't pool their resources together in their own kind of collection, and I'm not saying that those wouldn't even be good works at times, but the collection that happens at the assembly, that is never used for non-Christians in the Bible. So let me show you all the examples of this throughout the Bible. So in the New Testament, in Acts 2, they were collecting distributing their wealth and their whatever, and it was for all who believed. And then in Acts 4, it was for those who believed. And then in Acts 11, where Agabus, the prophet, comes, and he tells them that there's going to be famine in Jerusalem, he says to send relief to the brothers. And then in Romans 15, talking about the same collection, which is also this passage that we're looking at, talking about the same collection, they're bringing aid to the saints. And then in Romans 15:26, he talks about the poor among the saints. And then in 2 Corinthians 8:4, 9:1, 9:12, he talks about support for the saints. And then in 1 Timothy 5, verse 16, he talks about helping godly widows that are in need. And so those are all the examples that I know of in the Bible. And then obviously this one is for the saints who are in Jerusalem, which, again, the prophet Agabus talked about this famine that was going to come upon the land. Yeah, if you guys wanted to take a picture of it, those are all the examples. So there's not going to be any more of those on the PowerPoint there. And so what do you guys make of that? I know that this is not necessarily the main point of this passage, but I think it's something that people wonder and talk about today. So any thoughts or comments on that?
the same kind of argument we make regarding instrumental music. We list all the passages that speak about singing and observe that there's not one about the use of an instrument. And
that's right.
This proves the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, the evidence is pretty overwhelming. And that you just look at when the Christians pooled their resources together. Was it ever used for non-Christians? And the answer to that is no. Now, again, could I individually help people? Yeah, Galatians talks about helping, doing good to all people, and especially the household of the saints, which doesn't mean that we use that passage to justify only helping the saints on my own. But if I do have the ability and whatever and opportunities to help non-Christians, we'll certainly do that. But that's not the purpose of the collection. And I just think that this is one of those passages that opens some doors up to other themes that we see in the Bible. So that's why I wanted to bring all of those up just right here. Any other thoughts or comments just on that?
Maybe only to say that you kind of have said this a couple of times, but 1 Timothy 5, which you have up there with godly widows, is a place I would go to say that Scripture makes a distinction between what the church does collectively and what the individual does. And so that would be a good place to go to think more about that.
That's right, because in 1 Timothy 5, it talks about if there's a godly widow, to let the family help first, and if they can't, then the church will support the woman, the widow that fits that criteria. I remember there's some institutional people that I studied with in Minnesota. They were really nice people, but we disagreed on some of these points. And they said that whatever the individual Christian can do, the whole church can do with their money. So I said, so could the church open up a coffee shop in their lobby that people could get coffee at before services and after services? And they said, yeah, if it would help draw people in, then absolutely. And if you don't see that there's a distinction between what the church collectively can do with their treasury and what an individual can do, you start getting into some things that should be pretty obvious warning signs to us, but there are some really sincere people that believe those things, and we got to be able to gently show those things to them.
Well, in these days, the coffee shop is not that absurd an example anymore. You might have to find a more extreme one.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Good. All right. So we see that it's for the saints. Now let's move more to what the text itself is saying about this collection. He's saying to do it on the first day of the week. Now, can anybody rattle off in the Bible the different things that happen on Sunday in the Bible?
Jesus was raised.
Yep, good. Jesus' resurrection was on a Sunday. What else?
Saints gathering together.
Yep, saints gathering together. We know that in Acts chapter 20, verse 7, where they're taking the Lord's Supper together. We know that from this passage when they're gathering together to take up a collection, it seems. What else?
Of the church on Pentecost.
Yeah, Pentecost was on a Sunday, so Acts chapter 2 happened on a Sunday. I heard somebody say one time that, remember, it's the third hour of the day, which means that that's the scriptural time that a church must meet. but I think that was only for Bible class. I think service was actually at 10. But
which time zone?
Yeah, it was in Florida. so we're in the right time zone for that. Anything in the Old Testament that happened on the first day of the week?
God made light.
Yeah, God made light. The first day of creation was on a Sunday because it was on the last day of the week that he rested, which was on a Saturday, which means that the first day he started working was on a Sunday. And then you've also got the Feast of First Fruits that took place during the Passover week in the Old Testament, where they would hold the sheaf of grain up to God. And that mirrors how Jesus on the third day into Pentecost, which is when the first fruits would be offered, they would hold these sheaves up, like what's behind Sam Friesmeier's background there. They would hold these up to God, like to recognize that they've been given these things, and Jesus was risen up. And so there's some interesting parallels with that. So this is another thematic thing. This is another one of those passages that show what they did on the first day of the week. But they're supposed to collect or give as they prosper. Which means that if you're prospering, then you give. If you're not prospering, that may mean that you're not able to give as much as you would like to. And so the Bible, the New Testament, doesn't come around and say tithe or 10% or whatever. It's as you may prosper. And so there's individual decisions that we have to make about some of those kinds of things. But he says that he wants them to make sure that they're collecting so that there's no collecting that has to happen when he comes. What do you think he means by that in verse 2?
Well, Paul is going to be coming to them, and he wants them to take some forethought to plan for this work that they're going to do together.
Right, so they don't have to, like, in an emergency kind of way, scrape together a bunch of funds that they have been collecting this. They do have a treasury. They do have a place that they're storing all this money for this specific purpose. It's not like they're amassing money just to have some kind of comfort as a church. They're giving, they're amassing this money together for a specific purpose. He's been telling the same things in the Galatian churches to do the same thing. This is a theme in 1 Corinthians that Paul has been teaching the same thing everywhere he goes. Sewell, were you going to say something?
There are some translations that say lay something aside at home. But I think that would not fit with what Paul was saying, because if you laid it up at home and when he came, you'd have to go around and collect it all from home. So
right.
At home is not in the text. And so what he's saying is it be laid aside in a common treasury for
right.
the church, I believe, just as we undertake to do now.
Right. I believe that makes sense. And that makes sense with some of the things we see in Acts 2 and in Acts 4, that they were laying it at the apostles' feet and then they were distributing it. They had a treasury there in a sense, if we can use that word for what they had. Good. Okay, so that's the collection. I think that's a pretty familiar passage. Just wanted to point out a couple things about that. Anything else you guys want to say before we move on to Paul's travel plans that do have some relationship with the collection? Okay, let's go ahead and move to the next section here. Look at 1 Corinthians 16, verses 5 through 12. I will visit you after passing through Macedonia. For I intend to pass through Macedonia, and perhaps I will stay with you or even spend the winter, so that you may help me on my journey wherever I go. For I do not want to see you now just in passing. I hope to spend some time with you if the Lord permits, but I will stay in Ephesus until Pentecost. For a wide door for effective work has opened to me, and there are many adversaries. When Timothy comes, see that you put him at ease among you, for he is doing the work of the Lord as I am. So let no one despise him. Help him on his way in peace, that he may return to me, for I am expecting him with the brothers. Now concerning our brother Apollos, I strongly urged him to visit you with the other brothers, but it was not at all his will to come now. He will come when he has opportunity. Okay, so the Corinthians would want to know some of the travel plans. They would want to know who's coming to visit them, when Paul is planning on coming. So we've got Paul, we've got Timothy, and we've got Apollos, and some traveling that they may be doing. So Paul, when he writes this, where is he currently?
Ephesus.
He's at Ephesus. Anybody know what chapters in Acts Paul was at Ephesus? Think of the big riot.
Maybe 19?
Yeah, very good. So Acts chapter 19. So he probably wrote the book of 1 Corinthians around Acts 19, 21, 22. Somewhere in there is when he would have written this. But he says that he's planning on going where? Where's his next stop in this passage?
Macedonia.
Yes, very good. He's going to Macedonia. We see him going to Macedonia in Acts chapter 20. So the chronology of what we see in 1 Corinthians matches with what we see in the book of Acts. And I think just even as an apologetic sort of thing, that when you see Paul writing this and then it's corroborated by a different writer named Luke in the book of Acts, that it shows that these stories really interconnect well. And that's one of the, like, if all of this was a lie, if all of this was a fairy tale kind of stuff, you wouldn't really be seeing this kind of precision of corroboration, I think. And so you see these things working together, and I think that's just kind of a cool thing to point out. Now, Paul says that after he goes to Macedonia, he does want to go to Corinth, and he wants to perhaps spend the winter there. And the winter would be, in this part of the world, would be mid-November to early March. It's not good for traveling on boat that might be one of the reasons Paul had some shipwrecks, like at the end of the Book of Acts, is that they were taking a risk. And when they were traveling, it would have been in this time period where the seas were more tumultuous. So this was a period of time generally where people wouldn't do a lot of traveling. So Paul is perhaps wanting to be there at that point, but notice that he says, if the Lord permits. He says, this is what I would like to be doing, but I know that things may change. Just as an illustration, okay, so here's my pen. If I hold my pen like this with an open palm, how easy is it to take it out of my hand? It's pretty easy, right? What if I'm holding my pen like by clenching my fist like this and somebody wants to get the pen out of my hand? How much work is it going to take?
It's going to be a little harder.
It's going to be a lot harder, and what's going to happen to me in the process if I'm not going to let go? But they do get it out of my hand.
It's going to be damaged.
It's going to be damaged. I think our plans can be like that. Do you have plans for your future that you sometimes hold very tightly to? And as reality happens and as perhaps God's plans happen, those plans get ripped from you? The tighter you clench onto your plans, the more it's going to hurt when your plans don't go the way that you wanted them to. But if you hold it with an open palm, you can have your plans, but if they get taken away from you, you're not going to be hurt by it as much. So Paul would say things like, if the Lord permits. This is like what James says. Anybody knows, does anybody know what Paul ended up having to do with his travel plans? So it's in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 that Paul had to change his plans. He didn't end up being able to come in the same manner that he wanted to. And this was one of the things that the Corinthians were maligning Paul over, that he's vacillating. He said he would come, but he didn't come. And it was one of the things that they were using to discredit him. But he even says, Lord willing, you know, these are my plans. So those are Paul's travel plans. But I want to point out one other thing. In verse 9, Paul is in Ephesus, and let me ask this question. He says that where he is, there are open doors, but what are the things accompanying the open doors?
Riots and persecution.
Yeah. And the way he says it in verse 9 is that there are many adversaries, and that took the form of riots in Acts 19, persecutions in Acts 19. Have you ever heard people talk in terms of God opened a door for me, or this is a clear sign that I have an open door, or something like that? And oftentimes people will use that language to say that there's nothing standing in the way, that there's no adversaries, there's no barriers. It's a clear open door. And here when Paul says that there's an open door, he says that there's oftentimes adversaries that accompany an open door. And so if there's evangelistic work to do, and there's good work that we can be engaged in, just because there's people trying to stand in our way of doing that, or there's some kind of persecution or something like that, it doesn't mean we don't have an open door. Any comments or thoughts on that?
Comment about Paul. It would be interesting to have met and known Paul, because it did seem that that type of thing seemed to follow him.
Yes. It's like I heard one scholar say one time that whenever he travels, he was from Great Britain, but wherever he travels and preaches, he said, whenever I travel and preach, people serve me tea. But whenever Paul went anywhere, he started riots. any other thoughts on what Paul is wanting to do here? All right. So then we move to Timothy. I'm not going to say a whole lot about Timothy, but we know that Timothy is heading towards them. I believe 1 Corinthians 4 said that, or 3 said that he was going to be coming as well. I'm trying to remember where that verse is. I don't remember right now. But Timothy is heading towards Corinth. And what is Paul's big concern with Timothy?
They might make it hard on him.
Yeah, they say put him at ease, which and the reason is because he's doing the work of the Lord, like show respect to him. He's doing the Lord's work. But I wonder, it also says don't despise him, which is the same thing that Paul said to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4:12, let no one despise you for your youth. And he also told Timothy in 1 Timothy 5:23 to have some wine for his stomach ailment. And in 2 Timothy chapter 1, he's told to fan into flame the gift that he has. Timothy seems like he was perhaps easily intimidated or something like that. And Paul is just making sure that the Corinthians know that when he comes, like, treat him well. He struggles with some things, perhaps. So that's the instructions for Timothy. And then you've got Apollos. And Paul has been strongly urging Apollos to visit, perhaps because of the schisms in the first four chapters, that if Apollos can come, he can also be a voice of reason to show that people saying, I follow Paul, I follow Cephas, all of this kind of stuff is kind of silly, don't do that. Maybe that's one of the reasons Paul would have been wanting Apollos to do it. But Apollos was too busy to visit Corinth now. And I think it's interesting. Apollos didn't follow the urgings of Paul. Not everything Paul said was a command of the Lord. He did have relational advice that somebody like Apollos at times would say, now's not a good time for me, Paul. I'm sorry. I've got to stick to where I'm at right now, and then I'm eventually going to come. So anyways, those are just the people that they should be expecting. Sewell?
I wouldn't blame Apollos. I wouldn't want to get into that mess either.
Yeah.
But it's interesting when he says to make Timothy feel at ease and not be despised, but he's going into that exact mess where Paul's just gone through this whole riot. So, it's not a matter of go work on the silversmiths. It's the local brethren. Make sure they're not despising him.
Right. Yeah, because maybe Timothy didn't have the same kind of eloquence that somebody like Apollos had. And so maybe when Timothy is coming to visit, his preaching's not as good. Like, we don't need to really show him much attention or encourage him very much or anything like that. I don't know if it was something like that. But I don't recall anybody in chapter 1 saying that I follow Timothy. He wasn't as popular of a preacher or whatever. So I don't know how much of that would have been. It would have been tempting to perhaps kind of ignore him or not give him much respect or something. I'm not sure. Any other thoughts on that?
Well, just one other thought. Paul liked to go where the gospel hadn't been preached. And Apollos may have just been looking at the work he was doing versus going to a church where the Apostle Paul has been for some time.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Good. All right. So those are the travel plans. By the way, again, if the New Testament was a fairy tale, why do you have sections like this? You go read Homer's Odyssey, or you read the Quran, or you read even like the Book of Mormon. You're not going to see passages like this. But you're going to see passages like this in the Bible because these are real events. And the correspondence is a real correspondence between Paul and this church. Okay. Let's finish it out then with the final instructions and greetings. I'm going to put two discussion questions up here that you can be thinking about while we're reading. And it's going to deal with the first part of the section. So in verse 13, Paul's going to tell all the Corinthians, male and female, he's going to tell all of them to act like men. So what does that mean? And then also in verse 16, Paul's going to tell the Corinthians to be subject to certain people. So as we read those, try to be thinking about those questions. Then I'll have some more things to put on the PowerPoint after we discuss those questions. So let's go ahead and read 1 Corinthians 16, verses 13 through the end of the book. Be watchful, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong. Let all that you do be done in love. Now I urge you, brothers, you know that the household of Stephanas were the first converts in Achaia. By the way, that household in chapter 1, verse 16 was baptized. And at the end of the book, he calls them converts, some of the first converts. That they have devoted themselves to the service of the saints. Be subject to them as these, and to every fellow worker and laborer. I rejoice at the coming of Stephanas and Fortunatus and Achaicus, because they have made up for your absence. For they refresh my spirit as well as yours. Give recognition to such people. The churches of Asia send you greetings. Aquila and Priscilla or Prisca, together with the church in their house, send you a hearty greetings in the Lord. All the brothers send you greetings. Greet one another with a holy kiss. I, Paul, write this greeting with my own hand. If anyone has no love for the Lord, let him be accursed. Our Lord come. The grace of the Lord Jesus be with you. May love be with you all in Christ Jesus. Amen. All right, so here, some final things to kind of tie this letter together. You probably noticed how much he talked about love in these last verses. We'll say some things about that in just a moment. But like in verses 13 and 14, he's going to give like a spattering of a couple different instructions, one of which is act like men. All right, so what does it mean for all Christians, male and female, to act like a man? And by the way, does Paul ever take on any womanly or motherly characteristics at times? Does God ever take on any womanly characteristics, like in the book of Isaiah? Yeah, he does. So this is not a sexist comment, because there's a sense in which every man ought to adopt some things that are generally thought to be more feminine in the way that we're caring and gentle with people. But there's also things that every woman should adopt that are characteristic of men. And I think a passage like this shows this. So in what sense should every Christian act like a man?
Well, some other translations say be courageous or be brave.
Okay, good. Be courageous, be brave. What does that mean? And how else would we describe this?
I might think that one of the roles that the men had was battle. And the idea to stand firmly in battle and be brave was maybe considered a manly characteristic.
Right.
So that sort of a feeling to it.
Yeah, and like doing the right thing, even when nobody else is doing it. I think about David's Mighty Men, which I mean, I know that these are all men in David's Mighty Men, but they still give lessons to every Christian. Like, do you remember that one of David's Mighty Men who clung so hard to his sword that they had to like pry the sword off of him, but he fought all by himself when everybody else forsook him? Doing the right thing when nobody else seems to be doing it, doing the right thing when it comes at great exhaustion to you, acting like men, like not giving up. Now, the opposite of acting like a man may not be a gender thing even. It may be like instead of being childish, be a grown-up. Take responsibility, fight, do the right thing when there's temptations that are kind of facing you. So I think that would be the idea of that. Anything else you guys want to say about that one? All right, what does it mean to be subject in verse 16 to the household of Stephanus? Is he an elder or what? What's going on with this?
It does appear to be the same word that's used when it references being in subjection to Christ or wives to husbands. And there's even a verse where the saints are to be in subject to the elders. So there's this idea of submission, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, good. Does that mean that this guy's got like some kind of authority, or does it mean like as the first convert, he might have the best wisdom in the group? Like, listen to what he says, you know, like take seriously what these people say. They've got good insight into some of the problems that are happening there, something like that. Kind of seems to be along the lines of what's going on here, but any other thoughts on that?
Well, in addition to being the first convert, he mentions that they've devoted themselves to the work. So I'd be inclined to believe it's more about the devotion to the work rather than the fact that they were the first.
That's right, yeah.
So he's devoted himself to the work, so be subject. Maybe it's like follow that example.
That's right, yeah, good. So be subject to the example of somebody like this. Which, I mean, what if everybody in Corinth followed, like, what if everybody in Corinth was subject to that example? Do you think that would solve a lot of the problems?
Yeah.
It would. I love how there's times in the New Testament where, like, in 3 John, you've got Diotrephes, who's not a very good person. But Paul talks about the good examples, too, in that letter to follow. if all you can do is write a letter to somebody, but that person you're writing a letter to also is in the proximity of good examples that are living out the kind of instructions that you've been telling them, you can also say, pay attention to these people. And Paul will say things like this in other letters, that you pay attention, you think about the things that mature people are doing, and you imitate them. There's passages that talk about that. By the way, this series of classes, we've been incorporating some ideas on studying the Bible. Do we realize that the Bible tells us to study other things than just the Bible? And I don't mean just the Bible in any kind of like bad way. You understand that. But the Bible tells us to study other things as well. It tells us to study mature Christians. There's a sense in which it even tells us to study nature, that when Paul in Psalm 8 looks out at the skies, like, think about all the things that are around us. So the Bible tells us that there are other things to study as well, which all help us with our spirituality. So I think that's a good idea of what Paul's getting at here. Anything you guys want to say about that?
It's not just Stephanus, but it says, you know, subject to such as these and to every fellow worker and laborer.
Yes.
So it's really because he's devoted, and then you have these other fellow workers and laborers, these are the to be subject to. It's like, you know, this is an example for you, these laborers here. So
that's right. And I wonder if in verse 17, if some of these people were actually the ones that brought the letter from the Corinthians to Paul. Because he says that he rejoiced at the coming of Stephanus, Fortunatus, and Achaicus, because they made up for your absence. It's like he's gotten a little taste of the Corinthians by hanging out with three of them. Like, they've visited him while he's been in Ephesus, it looks like, and maybe the Corinthians had written this letter to Paul, and they present this to him. Paul's already talked to Chloe's people. So between the letter and Chloe's people, he's like, okay, well, I got to write this letter back to them that's going to address these things that I know about them and that they've asked me. So it seems like in verse 17, he's gotten a little bit of a taste of those people that he misses a lot. Yes,
somebody brought those questions.
What was that?
Someone had brought those questions that he answered. Right. Questions from the church in Corinth.
Yeah. And I it seems reasonable to me that in verse 17 it was these three people. So, all right. Anything else you guys want to say about that?
The other interesting thing is when it's in the last part where it says give recognition to such people, looking at the Greek for that, it's not only the kind of to recognize what they're doing, but it's also the idea. Let me bring it back up again. It's also the idea of becoming thoroughly acquainted with or to know. And so I think that I think that emphasizes your comment about them being a good example. So for us to recognize, to become acquainted with what type of people and what they're doing, I think is just highlighted by that last statement.
Okay, good. So like drawing near to them. So it's not just, okay, publicly acknowledge them, but recognize these things in these people's lives and draw near to them so that you can be encouraged in that same way. That's a good thought. I hadn't put that together with that. All right. We're obviously skipping some of the instructions that Paul gives here, but I do want to point out here at the end of the book, his emphasis on love in verse 14, everything they do should be done in love. And it's Valentine's Day, so it's very appropriate. He says in verse 22 that you're accursed if you don't love the Lord. And then also in verse 24, Paul sends his love with to the Corinthians, in a sense, to all of them. So he's ending the letter by talking about love, 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 which, again, if they could follow the example of somebody like Stephanus, and they could be loving, it would really solve, like, all of the problems that they had in Corinth. So they've got all the answers that they need. What they need to do now is get the proper motivation, which maybe part of that is verse 22. Look, if you don't love God, you are going to be accursed. There is going to be judgment if you don't put him first. And then also, you know, we can love because he first loved us. In 1 Corinthians 13, love was personified because I think love is something that was first shown to us in Jesus, and then we can replicate that towards other people. But anything else you guys want to say about the love thing? By the way, this reminds me a little bit of, the church at Ephesus in the book of Revelation. What was it that they left in Revelation 2, 1 through 7?
First love.
Yeah, they left their first love. Has anybody noticed in the final, like, three verses of Ephesians that Paul emphasizes love, like, three times there? And then all throughout the totality of Ephesians, how much he talks about how much God has loved us and how we need to walk in love as he loved us. Ephesians talks so much about love, but that's what they forsook. Ironically, 1st and 2nd Timothy were written to the preacher at Ephesus, and the emphasis in those letters was the false teaching. So it's like, to be a healthy church, they needed the book of Ephesians, and they needed the book of 1st Timothy. But they only focused on 1st Timothy, it seems, on the doctrinal questions. But anyways, I don't know how we got onto all of that. All right, so the greetings. He sends a couple greetings. The churches of Asia greet the Corinthians. The churches of Asia, like, they want to send greetings to them, even though they know some of the things about Corinth, I'm sure, by reputation. We've got Aquila and Priscilla sending greetings. Aquila and Priscilla, married couple that do a lot for the Lord together. They seem to be moving, and they're in a lot of different places in the book of Acts. They've been in Rome, and then I forget all the places that they are, but I think there's at least three locations that they end up in, doing the Lord's work wherever they are. So... all right, anything else you guys want to say as we close out our studies in 1 Corinthians?
That's been a good study, and Eric and Dave, I commend you for the work you've done in preparing and leading it, so thank you.
Yeah, and thanks to Dave for taking all the hard chapters. I mean, they all have their challenges, but...
That's just what I was going to say.
I think it's been a very useful study.
Yeah, I hope everybody, I'm sure Corinthians is a book that all of us have studied before, but every time we study through a book again, there's probably things in our life that's changed since the last time we studied this book, which I think opens us up to seeing things that we didn't see before. We're probably at a greater level of maturity, so we're going to be seeing other parts of the text that we're going to be challenged by in ways that perhaps we hadn't before, so... So this has been good for us to all go through this. I know it's encouraged me in a lot of ways.
Steve Carney started a church in Dublin, Ireland, and he went through the book of 1 Corinthians first, after he'd converted a few people. And when he finished, he just went right back and went over it again because he said that's what they needed most.
Because of the morality problems?
Covered so many, well, and ex-Catholicism and so on.
Oh, okay. Yeah, if I was going to have, like, a top five books that I would go through with a new convert, for me, I just go through Mark, Acts. I really like 1 Peter and 1 Timothy because 1 Timothy deals with some of the doctrinal things, and inherent within that book is the importance of being part of a local church because Timothy is a preacher at this church and is talking about things happening at that church. And so 1 Timothy, and then I would say also 1 Corinthians, that those are all really – if any of you are involved in teaching others, I know there's a lot of people here that are. Maybe you've picked up some things, too, to help with some of that work that you're doing as well. Cool. Good to see all of you. I'm glad that I was able to teach it and that I haven't started throwing up yet.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. All right. Good to see all of you.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, Eric.